योऽन्तः प्रविश्य मम वाचमिमां प्रसुप्तां सञ्जीवयति अखिलशक्तिधरस्य धाम्ना अन्यांश्च हस्तचरणश्रवणत्वगादीन् प्राणान् नमो भगवते पुरुषाय दुभ्यं वि बो डौन् बिफोर् दि अब्सल्यूट् रियालिटि इन् द फोर्म् आफ् दि आल्मैटी लार्ड् हु एनर्जैसस् द होल् क्रियेशन् योगेन चित्तस्य पदेन वाचां मलं शरीरस्य च वैद्यकेन योपाकरोत्तं प्रवरं मुनीनां पतञ्जलिं प्राञ्जलिरानतोऽस्मि. So we are continuing our discussion on the sutras of Patanjali. I gave a brief analysis of India's philosophical systems and the unique place that Patanjali's system occupies among the orthodox systems of Indian philosophy. So I think I gave an outline in the last class. So in the last class, we were dealing with the second sutra, Yogaha Chitta Vritti Nirodhaha. That is the second sutra. Literally, it means yoga is restraining the mind stuff, chittam, from taking various forms, various modifications. Now here, before continuing, we need a short discussion on the method, the different ways in which the vrittis operate in chittam. So the operation of vrittis in chittam are divided into five categories. We will be able to understand how our own mind functions. Technically, there are five names, five states in which chittam manifests itself, the mind stuff. In Sanskrit, they are called kshiptam, mudham, vikshiptam, ekagram, niruddham. These are the five steps. I should explain one after another. The first stage is kshiptam, and that is very natural for most of the people. Wavering. It's like a lake full of waves. Vrittis, or these modifications within this mind stuff, chittam, can be compared to waves. And the chittam itself can be compared to a lake. So vrittis or modifications are waves, and our mind stuff or chittam is a lake, and then our true nature is the bottom of the lake. Now when we look at a lake which is moving, full of waves, ripples, we won't be able to see the bottom. If the waves subside, we will get a clear picture of the bottom of the lake. All spiritual practices are sometimes compared to an attempt to clean up a dirty, muddy lake. Not only in Yoga Sutras, but in generally speaking, all spiritual practices, when we read holy books, when we take the name of God, when we contemplate, when we meditate, when we try to meditate, all these are attempts to clean up this lake of our mind stuff. Now, how do we clean up a lake? Say, for example, it has got maybe, it is 100 meters deep. 90 meters are full of different layers of mud, filth, weeds, and so on. Only 10 meters on the top are filled with pure water. Now, when we want to clean up the lake, we have to take a long pole, a stick. We steer the lake. So when we try to steer the lake with the intention of cleaning it up, all the mud, filth, dirt, all will come to the surface. That's why when we try to meditate, all conflicting thought currents come to the surface. If you are walking idly in the street, no problem. If you are reading a novel, a short story, if you are watching a sport, 49ers, no problem. Mind is absolutely free from conflicts. But the moment you try to read a good book as an attempt to start a new life, to gather some spiritual ideas, suddenly mind itself projects some objections. Intellect wants to do it, but mind is not willing to cooperate. Similarly, when we try to meditate, you sit for some time, conflicting thought currents come to the surface. If you are sitting idly without any attempt to meditate, no problem. So only when you take a long stick and steer the lake, then only this filth and dirt will come to the surface. Otherwise, no problem. The lake appears to be calm and quiet. It is really not calm and quiet. It's full of dirt and filth. So it is said that the first stage is kshiptam, wavering. That's very natural. When mind and senses of perception, like eyes and ears, flow towards an object, we come to know of different objects in this world. So cognition is nothing but an attempt of the mind to cognize something with the help of any of the five senses of perception. With eyes and mind together, you see. With the ears and mind together, you hear, and so on. But then all these experiences keep the mind wavering, changing. This is the normal state of human beings. Pleasure and pain, happiness, unhappiness. So mind goes on wavering from one stage, one experience to another experience. The second stage, according to Patanjali, is called mudha state. Mostly the condition of people who are brutes or idiots, strong undesirable intentions. They can't think of anything higher values. The absolute idiots are very few in number, just as absolutely intelligent people are. So this is called mudhavastha. Mudha means dormant, not expressing anything. The third stage is vikshipta, means you are making an attempt to concentrate, but you have not reached a high stage. That's a state maybe people who belong to the preliminary state of spiritual progress. When we try to read some good books, try to practice spiritual sadhanas, do spiritual practices, there will be, of course, some wavering conflicts, but still there is an attempt to concentrate. The fourth stage is ekagra. That's a state where mind has succeeded in concentration, in achieving a very high level of concentration. Now, this concentration is possible even without practicing yoga. You find people are extremely concentrated in doing certain work in which they are interested. But there's a natural flow of mind, mental modification, towards an object because we are interested in it. A great scientists, great musicians, people who have achieved something unique in their life, not necessarily yogis, are able to concentrate their mind. Otherwise, they will not be able to make any distinct contribution in any branch of life. So, but then yoga says this concentration should become a positive step towards spiritual enlightenment. When we try to concentrate with the intention of focusing our mind on a higher spiritual goal, it is called yoga. So, I mentioned in the last class the dynamics of concentration. Concentration or focusing of all our energy powers on one point without internal discipline may help us to achieve great things in this world. Great scientific discoveries were possible because scientists could concentrate intensely on this research, scientific research experiments. Great musicians were able to compose great musical compositions because at one point they are able to forget everything and leave everything behind and identify themselves with what they have in mind, music. See, you may have heard of it, Dostoevsky was practically a drunkard. Most of the time he was unconscious. He was under the power of vodka. He was totally unconscious of anything. He would be taken into the debtor's prison. At that time he started writing Brothers Karamazov because he was afraid he would be taken to the debtor's prison. And that became the immortal classic, one of the greatest creations in modern creative literature. Great musicians, sometimes a terrible, shocking experience enabled them to compose great music, great painting. All these are possible. These are examples of concentration, not yogi concentration. These concentration, these types of concentrations may help us to achieve something great in life, but it doesn't transform our inner life, inner personality. This transformation takes place when we concentrate after getting fully established in the 10 fundamental disciplines that I explained briefly in the last class, yamas and niyamas, which I mentioned earlier. Ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, aparigraha, tapas, shauja, santosha, swadhyaya, ishvara pranidhana. 10 disciplines. I shall explain once more to make this the present topic more clear. A person who is not established in non-violence, is not established in contentment, is not established in truthfulness, if he achieves tremendous power through concentration, that concentration will only help him to be more evil, to be a greater evil, to practice more violence. So Patanjali lays down that this yogic concentration should be practiced after being fully equipped with some fundamental moral, spiritual disciplines. I discussed this subject in the last class, and in fact, these sutras dealing with yamas and niyamas will be dealt with later in another chapter, not in the first chapter. I just mentioned at this stage, that's all. Because egagra means slowly the vritti is getting concentrated. In the ordinary case, what happens? Our mind is distracted. Eyes take the mind towards visual objects. Ears drag the mind towards objects which are producing sound. The sense of touch drags the mind towards different objects which we pursue through touch. And perhaps nostrils will drag the mind towards an object from where a perfume, a good smell is coming, and so on. So all these distractions should be eliminated and mental energy should be concentrated on one point. This, when achieved in science, leads to a great discovery. In music, leads to great composition. But in yoga, it helps us to transform our life, to understand our true nature. And what's our new true nature? Our true nature is that we are inherently divine. This idea is said by Patanjali also. We have to remember, yoga doesn't bring a new knowledge from outside. Yoga helps us to rediscover, to understand our own personality. See, the bottom of the lake is already within the lake. What we are trying to do is to remove the dirt and filth and mud that is covering the bottom of the lake. As I said, lake is compared to our mind stuff, bottom of the lake to our true nature. And all these visual objects, mental distractions, have brought in dirt, filth and mud into this mental lake. That should be cleaned up. Then we can see the rock bottom. We can realize our own true self. This is the purpose of yoga. So yoga enables us to discover our true nature by revealing our true real self, by removing all dirt and filth. In the process, Patanjali will tell you, when we develop this power of concentration, mind becomes a great friend and mind also becomes a powerful weapon. All the great things in the world were achieved by people who sharpened their mental faculties by concentration. But in yoga, it helps us not to achieve something great in the external world, but by revealing our true self. The fifth state of chittam, mind stuff, is niruddham, where all modifications are completely eliminated. We experience that state at the time of samadhi. These are the five states of chittam. Now, in the earlier sutra, we already discovered, I shall just recapitulate what we discussed in the last class. First sutra, Atha Yoga Anushasanam. Atha here stands for at the time when we are convinced that this empirical world, this secular empirical pleasures cannot give us eternal peace. And then when we are mentally ready to knock at the door of spirituality, at that time, yoga is to be expounded. That's the meaning. And then in the second sutra, there is a brief definition of the cessation of mental modifications. What is yoga is being defined. Yoga chitta vritti nirodha. What is yoga? It is chitta vritti nirodha. Please understand, yoga means union between the individual self and the universal self. Right now, we identify ourselves with our false identity. When we identify ourselves with our body, we are limiting our own personality from the higher spiritual dimension to the lowest physical level. So we must go beyond these false identifications, and we must be able to identify ourselves with the cosmic universal reality, supreme bliss, that is omnipresent, that is immanent, that is omniscient, that is of the nature of absolute knowledge, bliss, and existence. This Jiva Brahma Aikya means the joining of the individual self and the universal self. This is yoga. This is achieved by leaving behind our lower identifications. We identify ourselves with the body, and then we become proud of this body. Everybody knows that this body is not eternal. Then we identify with our mind, which is again not eternal. It's always wavering. So also intellect. Going beyond body, beyond intellect, beyond mind, we identify ourselves with the eternal, everlasting, supreme reality. This is possible only by retaining, by completely restraining, by transcending the modifications which exist in our mind stuff. This is the second sutra. The third sutra, of course, it says what happens when we reach that state of complete retention, complete cessation of mental modifications. At that time, we get fully established in our true nature. These three sutras we have already completed. Today, we are going to deal with the fourth sutra. The fourth sutra is Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra. Itaratra means in all other conditions, till we achieve this samadhi state, till we achieve this yogic enlightenment, what happens? We identify ourselves with whatever we see, hear, smell, touch, and so on. For that, we need some description, some explanations are required. Normally, Patanjali says, our external eye is only an insignificant instrument of the human personality. What actually perceives a visual object is not the eyes, not a pair of eyes, but the mind that is at the back of the eyes and also the nervous system. To give you an example, we may be fully awake, our eyes are open. We may be seeing the visual object right in front of us. Or there is a big automobile right close to us, making a loud noise. But if our mind is not directed in that direction, not going in that direction, we won't be seeing the visual object. We may be staring at it, but we may be apparently looking at it. But eyes will not help, eyes will not be able to bring that cognition to our intellect if mind is not there. So mind and eyes should come together. And then what happens? When we really see a visual object, our mind stuff takes the form of that visual object. That's why great painters are able to do a painting. Maybe you may go to an art gallery in the morning, and evening, if you're an artist painter, you may be able to draw a painting similar to the drawing that you saw in the art gallery. You may listen to a music in the morning. If you carefully listen to that music, you may be able to reproduce the same music in the evening. We are hearing it, actually. Memory is a kind of reliving of the previous experience. Otherwise, memory has no value. This is possible even after several years. Maybe 10 years back, we may have seen an object. If we registered a strong memory in our system, we will be able to relive that experience, re-experience that object again today. Because it has registered strongly in our mind stuff. Because when we see that object, our mind stuff, chittam, it's called chittam in the Patanjali system, takes the form of that visual object. It becomes one with that. When we hear a sound, our chittam, mind stuff, takes the form of that audio phenomenon, the sound system. Again, the same thing happens with regard to the association of mind and the sense of touch, mind and the sense of smell, and so on. So, under all normal circumstances, till we reach this state of complete cessation of modifications of the mind, till the vrittis are completely focused or transcended, till they cease to exist, so long as these vrittis are wavering, vrittis are functioning, the mind stuff is not steady, we always identify ourselves with all the objects, visual objects, audio objects, and also all other experiences. So Patanjali says, in all other circumstances, we identify ourselves with all these different objects. Samana agaratum and tadhatmi brahmam. It means, the point is this, mind stuff takes exactly the form of the experienced object. And then what happens? We frequently forget our own true nature. Every sensory object, directly or indirectly, takes us away from our true nature. Just as in the lake, the more and more dirt and filth get concentrated, it blocks the view of the bottom of the lake. So that is the meaning. And then we go to the sixth sutra, not the fifth one. We will come to the fifth sutra later. In fact, the sixth sutra is very important from a philosophical point of view. It needs some explanation. The sutra is this: Pramana, Viparyaya, Vigalpa, Nidra, Smritayeha, sixth and seventh. Pratyaksha, Anumana, Agamaha, Pramanani. So, before going to the fifth and sixth, I will deal with the seventh sutra. It's a tradition, because Patanjali wrote these sutras not in a very, very systematic manner. So very often when we study in modern times, sometimes scholars will introduce some changes. So next we go to the seventh sutra. The seventh sutra actually deals with a purely academic topic, which we must understand at the very beginning of study of Patanjali's system as a school of philosophy. The seventh sutra deals with the epistemology of Patanjali's system as a school of thoughts. Epistemology means the school of theory of knowledge, science of theory of knowledge. What are the criteria? What are the instruments, the tools, the epistemological tools in Patanjali's system? That should be understood. Patanjali accepts only three tools of epistemology: Pratyaksha, Anumana, Agamaha, Pramanani. Pramanani means these tools of knowledge: direct perception, inference, and verbal testimony. These are the three tools which Patanjali accepts. I should explain in detail a little bit of the epistemology of Indian schools of philosophy. In Indian systems of philosophy, right from the cutthroat materialism, it's called Charvaka system, which I explained in last class of Brihaspati, to Vedanta, different schools of thought, different philosophers accept different sets of tools of epistemology. For example, Indian materialists do not accept Vedic literature, Vedas, Gita, or any theological or received wisdom as a source of knowledge. According to Indian materialism, you know, you have to remember they must have flourished around 3000 BC. It's one of the ancient systems. According to them, direct perception is the only tool of human cognition. When you see something, when you hear something, when you touch something, when you smell, that's the only tool for them. So, and these Indian materialists in ancient times were divided into two broad schools. One was the accidentalism, naturalism, hedonism, quite a few schools. Of which two schools only I mentioned, then I pass on to some other systems of philosophy. Because in the coming sutras, to understand Patanjali's system as a system of philosophy, not just as just a meditative method, as a system of philosophy, we must be able to place Patanjali's system in the broad spectrum of the evolution of Indian thought. So the most primitive, in many ways, the most primitive system is Charvaka system, which must have flourished around 3000 BC, that means more than 5000 years back. Its exponent was Brihaspati. According to him, direct perception is the only tool. Inference, verbal testimony, these tools have no value. So if you ask those philosophers, why is the fire hot? They would say, it just happens to be so. So it's called Yadrichavada, or called accidentalism. It just so, that's all. And also naturalism. So this is the one school that we had to deal with. The second school of philosophers, it's called the Buddhist philosophers, Bauddhas. They believed only in direct perception and inference. They also did not believe in what is called received wisdom. You have to remember, it's a bit too academic, but I know that it's not so easy to understand, but it has a place in Patanjali's system. Patanjali's system of yoga is not something related to physical exercises. It has got a great depth and academic distinction. That's why I'm explaining its epistemology and its metaphysics. So, as I said, the most primitive of the Indian systems of philosophy is the Charvakas, the Indian materialist. The second one is, you know, the Bauddha system. They did not believe in the testimony of Vedas. They did not care for any received wisdom. They also believed only in direct perception, it's called pratyaksha, and anumana, which is called inference. Now, Sankhya system and Yoga system, they believed in pratyaksha, anumana, and shabda pramana, means direct perception, inference, and verbal testimony. And according to Patanjali did not believe in God as such. Patanjali's system is considered to be orthodox and theistic. Theism in Indian philosophical tradition did not imply belief in God. Theism in Indian philosophical tradition implied belief in the authority of the Vedas. That's a very important difference between India's philosophical tradition and the Greek and the Brahmic schools of thought. In India's tradition, theism did not necessarily imply belief in God. It implied belief in the authority of the Vedas, which, of course, accepted God, but then those who believed in these systems were not expected to completely be dependent upon Vedic teachings. They can have their independent thinking, speculation, and so on. We'll come to that. So, And Sankhya and Yoga. Sankhya is the scientific theory part. Yoga is the practical aspects. So both of them believed in the existence of some enlightened great teachers who have practiced yoga and realized the supreme truth, but not necessarily in a creator God. Then there were two famous systems, Nyaya and Vaisheshika. Both of them believed in four tools of epistemology: direct perception, that is pratyaksha, inference, anumana, comparison, upamana, and shabda, which is called verbal testimony. Nyaya system was related to Gautama, and Vaisheshika system. They believed in direct perception, inference, and also in comparison and verbal testimony. There were certain schools of philosophers in India who believed in eight tools of epistemology. And there were some schools who believed in six tools of epistemology. Vedanta, for example, accepted six: pratyaksha, anumana, upamana, sabda, arthabhati, anubalabdhi. Means direct perception, inference, comparison, verbal testimony, presumption, and absence. Absence of something is also a source of knowledge. That is a unique feature of Indian system, Indian epistemology. Many comparative philosophers didn't recognize the uniqueness. In India's philosophical system, absence of information is a source of knowledge. You are informed that it doesn't exist there. That's the point. Yes, absence of information is also a source of knowledge. So abhava was supposed to be a source of knowledge in Indian system. And there were some other fringe groups who believed in eight tools of epistemology. So they will add two more items. That is hearsay. And also direct experience, which they may not have experienced, but they may have just read or heard. All these tools were included in anumana, in inference or presumption by the earlier thinkers, but there were some fringe groups called Pauranikas, those who were writers of the mythological books. And then there were certain philosophers, not many, just a few, who added two more tools. That's something very funny. They believed in exclusion and external gesture. They call, Parishesha and Chesta. Parishesha is, to make you understand how they extended their epistemological thinking. To give an example, suppose you are living in a room or you are teaching in a class, you find that a heavy object was suddenly taken away from the table and kept on a higher spot in the room, maybe on a table or somewhere. Now, you ask all your students, if you are a school teacher, did you do that? Are you behind the mischief? And everyone denies. Then finally you spot one man, there is a mischievous smile on his face. He doesn't say he did not do that. He doesn't say he did do that. So you just exclude all others and you come to a conclusion, this must be the culprit who has done this mischief. So just I'm giving an example. In some of the ancient Indian systems, 10 tools of epistemology were recognized. The last one is exclusion. Suppose he's a tall man and powerful and slightly mischievous, and you can infer as much seeing his face, then you come to a conclusion, this must be the culprit. So this is the classical example given by the Indian logicians in their textbooks called Parishesha. So I'm just giving an example. So in Patanjali system, you have to remember, first, he accepts only direct perception, inference, and verbal testimony. Second point, remember, Patanjali doesn't insist on the existence of a creator God who is responsible behind everybody. But he does accept some enlightened people, enlightened great spiritual teachers, and he equates them to divine beings. But the idea of a conventional monotheistic God who creates this world and who directs all activities in his creation, that idea is absent in Patanjali's system. This much we must understand before we proceed further. Now we come to the next fifth and sixth sutra. He Patanjali says, Vrittaya Panjatayaha Klishtaha Aklishtaha. The modifications of mind stuff belong to two broad categories. Some of them are pleasant, some of them are unpleasant. Some of these modifications are related to ignorance, and some of them are related to knowledge. Some of them are pleasant, some of them are absent. In the sixth sutra, he explains Pramana Viparilya Vigalpa Nidra Smrtayaha. So here there's a long description. First, Patanjali says some of these vrittis are goods. They are based on knowledge. They have a logical explanation. Some of them not. But at the same time, some of the vrittis can take us away from our supreme goal. Some of them can take us towards our spiritual goal. So, first we have to remember, Patanjali compares our mind stuff to a lake, and all the modifications that are created in this mind stuff, in this lake, are covering the lake so that we are not able to see the rock bottom of the lake. The purpose of yoga is to see the rock bottom. The rock bottom of the lake is our true self. Due to modifications, different samskaras and tendencies accumulated in the mental stuff, we are not able to understand our true nature. These vrittis are accumulated by actions involving the five senses of the mind, five senses of perception, and five senses of action, plus mind. How these vrittis operate, this idea I am going to explain now. Suppose we see an object in front of us. There is not enough light. It resembles a human being, and also it may be mistaken to be a wall, or maybe some kind of visual object. When we see that object from a distance, our mind suddenly speculates, is it a human being or is it a wall? At that time, our mind is in what you call in kshipta state, is wavering. On the one hand, there is a thought, it is a human being, but not sure. On the other hand, there is a counter thought, no, it is a wall. Now, when we approach that object, we are convinced that it is a human being. At that point, this mind stuff stops functioning. the intellect starts functioning. Buddhi, mind, from mana to buddhi. So, intellect says it is a human being. That's why mind is defined as sankalpa, vigalpatmika, antakarna vritti. Antakarna means the internal organs. Our personality is antakarna. One compartment, one of the five compartments of this antakarana, these internal organs, is mind. Mind never remains steady. Mind is always disturbed by different tendencies, thought currents, ideas, speculations, and so on. These speculations, these tendencies do not get concentrated. So we speculate whether it's a human being or something else. When we reach the object, we come to a definite conclusion that it is the figure of a human being. At that time, intellect starts functioning. So the same vritti, the same modification of chittam, changes into nischayatmika andhakarna vritti. Means it becomes a mental modification which helps us to decide that it is a human being, not a wall. Now, as you work, as you proceed further, you suddenly remember, well, this is the person whom I saw last week. There are two types of mental modifications start functioning. One, you identify yourself as the person who saw him last week. And you identify that object to be the person whom you saw last week. So your ego, aham, pritti, and also your memory, all these come together. So these vrittis function as mind, intellect, memory, and also as the I consciousness. Now all these experiences will bring in different tendencies and impressions. These tendencies, when they get solidified, they become vasanas. So vasanas are strong patterns of behavior. As I said last class, we sometimes find that we cannot but act in a certain way, in a given manner, or speak in a given manner, as if we are propelled. Even if we decide to behave differently, we are not able to do that. The reason is, our accumulated tendencies becoming vasanas constitute our human behavior and character, which make us function and behave in a given manner, or which prevent us from behaving in a different manner. So these vrittis, solidifying, becoming residual factors, constitute the essence of our character. This character makes us behave in a particular manner. And this behavior again brings in fresh vrittis. Yoga is the guide. Yoga is a system which helps us to guide our actions, our behavior, in a particular manner, that it doesn't create more vrittis, rather it helps us to slowly stop this wavering of mind stuff, these modifications within the mind stuff. So when we get completely concentrated into one single spiritual tendency, it's called Mahavritti, we succeed. If we can reduce distractions, and let our mind, our time and energy flow in one direction that is helpful in spiritual life, then we have succeeded. And next step is complete cessation of the vrittis. So today we have, if you want, you can ask questions. We will have about 10 minutes. We can ask questions related to topics discussed today or in the last class.
Is that correct to say that spiritual practice is a process of
In a way, it is correct. That's called rediscovering, coming back to our true nature. In a way, when we remove the filth and dirt from the lake, it is a kind of removing what we have by mistake accumulated there. So that is true. But it's better to say rediscovering. We are not getting any new knowledge. The lake is already there. The bottom of the lake is not a new creation. We just remove the dirt and filth and we see the rock, bottom of the lake. That's the idea behind. Yes. Here, Lord Krishna is making a common statement, an analysis of the behavior that we find in this world. He's not giving a new spiritual ideal. He's explaining the normal nature. Now, see, here, there is a statement where Lord Krishna says, you know, mind is always of a wavering nature. It doesn't mean that mind can never stop wavering. Lord Krishna is giving a detailed description of what we find in this world. It is not an ideal, but the same Lord Krishna says, Ida Dipo Nibadasto Ningade Sopamas Pradaha. So we find here. So we should be able to control our chittam tendencies so that our mind should be like a lamp with the wicks not flickering, you know. So he's making a common sense statement, just a description of what we normally find in this world.
So it is possible to change the nature.
Yes, it's nature. In fact, yoga is a fight against nature. Our nature is instinctive. Our normal nature is eyes take your mind away towards visual objects. Ears take your mind towards audio objects. This is nature. So, but yoga is nothing but stopping the mind from being dragged away from the higher goal. Yoga is a fight against, a struggle against nature. If we follow the ways of nature, we won't be any better than animals. Yoga takes us away from the human to divine dimension. All animals follow nature, the dictates of nature. Yoga teaches us to tell our own nature, external nature, no. Our true, not true nature, the nature that we find ourselves in. When we use the word yoga enables you to realize your true nature, tada drashtu surupe avasthanam. The drashtu surupe, drashta means the witness. Drishya is the objects. So what is the true nature of the subject? That is Atman. Or that is the state where we are calm and quiet. And the Gita says, you know, that apuryamanam ajala pradishtham samudram apapravishanti yaddu. Taddu kamayam pravishanti sarve sacha antimapnodi na kama kami. All the rivers empty their waters to the ocean. But the ocean remains undisturbed. So to be disturbed is not the nature of ocean. True nature. Similarly, our true nature is not a state of disturbance or wavering. It is a state of perfect tranquility and calmness. Then there's other nature, the nature of biological world, the nature of instincts, the nature of sensory world. That is different. That's what Lord Krishna is. In fact, he tells you this to ask you to go away to transcend this state. That's the idea.
So there is a true nature.
Yes. Sadrisham cheshtade susya prakrute jnanavanapi. So prakriti itself means, you know, prakashena kriti means what we find primitive part of evolution is prakriti. We will come to that. We have just started the class. The purpose of yoga, Patanjali system, is to remove all the superimpositions, all the weeds and dirt that have filled our mind, external things. Remember, this language may be a bit unpleasant. The idea is we identify ourselves with so many other non-spiritual aspects, mind, body. So when we interpret ourselves as this body, psychophysical mechanism, we go after material wealth, all the disturbances, all the problems. On the other hand, if we identify ourselves with our true spirit, Atman, then we are able to look upon disempirical things as a witness, not as a participant. The ability to look at as a witness and not as a participant. That's the goal of yoga. That's what Swami Vivekananda says. Experience is the ultimate goal. Yoga is a method of taking you towards that experience through analysis of our own personality, our own mind. That's why there is one sutra, Ishvara Pranidhanatva, you find, in fact, complete surrender to God is one way to get established in these fundamental disciplines. If you completely surrender yourself to a divine ideal, divine spiritual person, divine object, then naturally our mind, our activities, our tendencies get oriented towards the divine core. So that's helpful in preparing ourselves to become fit for the practice of yoga. So experience is the last goal and only goal. That's what yoga is teaching. We have just started. This is an analysis of human mind tendencies. Some of them as you proceed, you find some of the descriptions are a bit academic, a bit too psychological. But if you analyze ourselves, find whatever we do creates a residual impression in our mind. If that action brings happy results, you will have a tendency to do it, to repeat that action, even if it is not necessary. And if that action produces unpleasant result, you will try to run away from that action, even if it is essential. So, raga and dvesha, attachment and aversion. This is how mind reacts. And this is how vrittis are formed. So, some of the vrittis are pleasant, klishtaka. Some of them are unpleasant, aklishtaka. In this sutra, I find here. Cessation. So, really speaking, in actual practice, you know, we are first of all trying to reach the highest single vritti by removing all these multitudes of vrittis. Right now, innumerable vrittis are already concentrated in our mind stuff. That's why people behave in so many peculiar, different ways, different times, different attractions, obsessions, aversions, and so on. So when we practice yoga, what happens? Before we succeed, before we reach the complete cessation of all vrittis, one single great vritti is formed. When mind gets, all vrittis get completely focused on the spiritual goal. Finally, that also disappears. At that time, we attain complete union with the universal self.
Swamiji, is there certain qualification that you need to go into yoga?
Yes, last time I mentioned in the Samadhipada, you find a description of 10 disciplines, yama and niyamas. Yamas, they constitute 10 fundamental disciplines. I shall explain briefly once more. Patanjali says, one should never practice yoga before getting fully established in these moral and spiritual disciplines. Because practice of yoga helps you to concentrate your mind. When you succeed in concentrating your mind, you attain tremendous power. And dynamism, energy, force you get. Just to give an example, if you practice pranayama with inner retention, antakumbhaka, you find suddenly you become restless. If you take strong coffee 4 times a day and practice plenty of pranayama, you become restless. If you take stronger drinks, it's much more worse. Why? Because these foodstuff upsets the mind, and along with that, when you practice pranayama, to give an example, pranayama is one of the ashtangas, you know, or even some of the complicated asanas, like sirsasana and all that. Very dangerous to practice without getting fully established niyamas and niyamas, and also without practicing disciplines of food and dieting and all that. So what happens, unless you get asthma or you get schizophrenic problems, phobias, reference of persecution and so on, or many delusions and such problems you get. So that's why the greatest yoga teacher of modern times, I mean Hatha Yoga, physical exercise, was Swami Sivanandaji, who is the founder of Divine Life Society. In one book, he advises people not to practice complicated physical postures without following some fundamental moral disciplines of life and also ideas. So I'm just giving an example. So Patanjali says 10 disciplines are a must. One is yama. Yama means ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, aparigraha. Ahimsa means non-violence. Now, yoga enables you to attain a tremendous power of mental concentration. You can learn things very fast. You can do things with extreme efficiency. So great intellectual mental powers automatically are generated through the practice of yoga. A man who is normally violent, if that man practices, or man or woman for that matter, practices yoga, you can imagine what happens. He becomes more violent. But remember, please remember, I'm giving example. Such persons will not be able to practice yoga beyond a limit. But even the preliminary practice of yoga will generate energy and heat in the body. Energy is created. This energy should be diverted to a creative, constructive channel so that slowly, step by step, you should reach the higher levels of yoga. But without getting fully established in these moral, spiritual disciplines, if one practices yoga and if he attains a very high level of energy and dynamism, what happens? This dynamism energy will be diverted towards undesirable channels. Persons who are extremely greedy, asteya and aparigraha, these are two fundamental disciplines for people to get rid of greed. Without these disciplines, if one practices, he may become an extremely successful businessman. But sometimes that may take him to undesirable channels. On the other hand, If we get established in ahimsa, the door is closed towards undesirable channels. So it's open only towards desirable channels. You are fully established in non-violence. You are fully established in absence of stealing, absence of greed, and then in chastity and in truthfulness, and also contentment, tapasvadhyayi sanupridhana, etc. So, contentment is a very important factor. It's called santosha, samyak tosha means contentment. You should be able to experience contentment with whatever you have. Otherwise, you know what happens? You become extremely hyperactive, hyper-energetic. So, and you are not contented. So, your mind is not a good friend at that time. Mind becomes a master. And not a very helpful master either. Because it becomes extremely active. But you are not fully established in these moral disciplines. What happens? If a terrorist gets a nuclear bomb, what happens? What happens? That's the same thing happens. A man who is naturally violent, if such a person gets a lot of power, energy, he will be able to do more harm. So if a person who is not established in purity of life, chastity, he becomes a profligate. So all these fundamental disciplines are necessary at the beginning of life in yoga. This I described in the first class itself. So Patanjali is very particular. So I just gave an example, you know, this breathing exercise and Hatha Yoga, they are certainly good. To give an example, along with that, if one doesn't practice discipline with regard to food, food could be interpreted not only as what we eat, but also what we feed our mind with. Good thoughts, good ideas. These are food for the mind. This is food for the body. Will help you to become physically healthy. Good food for the mind will help you to become mentally healthy. So all these are essential for a person to succeed in the practice of yoga. That's why Patanjali's system is very psychological and very scientific. I will explain these sutras later, because his sutras dealing yama, niyama come a little later. We'll discuss that later. And that's what I said, you know, reference of all these kind of evil practices, and then this is called a reference of persecution mania, doubtfulness and delusions, false thoughts. Suddenly you feel God is speaking to you. Speaking what? Advising you to do some evil to other persons. All these ideas come from the practice of concentration without fully getting established in the principles of non-violence, love, compassion, broad-mindedness, good feeling towards others. All these should be the prerequisites for one to practice yoga. Otherwise, our natural tendencies, natural propensities will get hyperactivated through the practice of yoga. If it is breathing exercise, some of the nervous system gets hyperactivated, which may have undesirable effect in the body, which will, on the other hand, be a great help, which will take you all the way to samadhi if you are fully established in yama and niyamas, these moral disciplines. Otherwise, it will drag you backward and throw you into a precipice. That's the other extreme. Yes, Ashtanga Yoga mentioned here. Patanjali, we'll deal with those sutras later. They are coming here.
Can we say that the saints have no mind?
Which one?
Saints have no mind.
Yes, their mind has become the mind of God. That's why. Their mind has expanded and has become the mind of God. They care for others. So, They don't have mind of their own. Their mind becomes a vehicle for God to function. That's that. In Vedanta and in devotional philosophy called prapatti, sharanagati, surrender, all these ideas, fine. That's not directly related to Patanjali system. It's a different system, psychological and philosophical system. I hope. So we'll conclude now. Any more questions? Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ram Krishna Paramastu.